This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. 40 days, 40 nights. The biblical reference has dark overtones. Imagine being tortured for that length of time. Well, our story today is about just that. Consider this. A deep-sea ROV, a remotely operated vehicle tethered by a cable, was cast adrift when that lifeline snapped. It happened about 60 miles north of Oahu this summer, while in waters 15,000 feet deep. Yikes. As if University of Hawaii President David Lassner, UH Manoa Provost Michael Bruno, and Ocean Sciences Dean Brian Taylor didn't have enough to worry about this summer. When we got wind of the story, we wondered why there was no acknowledgement of the initial loss or the rescue of the ROV named Lu'ukai. The name means sea diver in Hawaiian. One can only imagine that this was a heavy secret to keep. Academic careers may have been on the line, maybe even whole programs. At the time, no one knew if the Lu'ukai was lost for good. But it ended well, thanks to a privately funded research program funded by a very rich man with Microsoft ties. The late Paul Allen's ship, the Petrel, came to the rescue. We wanted to find out more and reached out to the pilot of the little ROV. His name is Max Creamer. We figured the ROV story, Lu'ukai, Lost and Found, was his tale to tell.
We were operating with our 6,000-meter or 20,000-foot rated, remotely operated vehicle, which is essentially a deep-sea drone. We were working about 100 kilometers or 60 miles north of Oahu at a place called Station Aloha. We had at first done a more industrial project with Professor Bruce Howe of UH Engineering. He is the principal investigator of the deepest internet-connected ocean bottom observatory in the world. It's called the Aloha Cabled Observatory. We were doing a servicing on that. That went very well for about 8 days or so. And then we went into a follow-up study, a background study, for a project called Abyssal Food Webs. The PIs on those is Jeff Drazen and Craig Smith, both professors of oceanography at the University of Hawaii. They do these days, they're heavily involved in the greater subject of deep sea mining. They're looking at the ecosystems that exist in those areas where the multinational mining companies would like to come in and harvest, as it's called, manganese nodules, also known as polymetallic nodules. They are highly enriched in very valuable elements such as cobalt, copper, nickel, manganese, anything you'd need to build batteries. Many, many billions of dollars worth down there, and everybody's licking their chops to get it. Of course, these are very fragile ecosystems. There's extremely low metabolism, extremely low sedimentation rates. So we were there in 2018 in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, about 1,500 miles south of Hawaii. And this year, in July, we did a background study just north of Oahu to see how it compares to those areas where all these nodules, these polymetallic nodules are. We were all happy because we had done the hard work, we thought, with Bruce Howe at the Aloha Cabled Observatory. And with Jeff and Craig, it's very interesting. We do very calm transects across the deep ocean plains for an hour or two, say 1 kilometer or so. And then we'll stop and we'll collect interesting organisms that nobody's ever seen before. And
piece
so
of cake.
It was just wonderful. We were enjoying ourselves. We had 3 days to go. And then we were going into a longer refit period where everybody could recharge. And on the third dive, we were minding our own business. Everything was working wonderfully. All the indications, electrical was great, power was great. The fiber optic telemetry was wonderful. Good images, nice samples. From 1 second to the next, all screens were black, blank, nothing coming up. And we said, that is not that unusual. You can lose telemetry just like you can lose a connection on your phone, say. I said, okay, well, let's restart the system and bring it back in. And so we restarted the system, and only one of the two components of the robot would come back, which is a heavy cage that hovers about 45 feet or so above the ocean floor and observes and provides power and telemetry to the actual robot that's working on the bottom. We got the cameras back for this cage that's called a TMS or tether management system. And into the camera comes a severed cable. And we were just slack-jawed because, oh my God, the $2.5 million investment that SOAS made to break into, you know, modern cutting-edge technology on the ocean floor is
It's
lost at 4,715 meters, that's 15,000 plus feet, on the abyssal plain in the middle of the northern Pacific. I mean, this is not the Gulf of Mexico where you have hundreds of operations where you can call a colleague and say, "Here, I lost my robot. Can you come help me out? Drag it back up."
So it's holy cow. What do we do next?
It was literally, holy cow, what are we going to do? It's interesting. That's why I love to have younger people that come into the organization. They have, you know, great enthusiasm. They think outside the box. And then, you know, oftentimes they say things that the older guys, you know, tend to dismiss or something. But this one guy, Daniel Hinshaw, is a mechanical engineer, and he's also one of the manipulator operators so far. I'm sure he's going to become a pilot soon. He said, "You know, I think the research vessel Petrel, that's Paul Allen's vehicle, you know, Paul Allen from Microsoft, I think they're somewhere in the Pacific." And we're like, "Well, what does that mean, somewhere in the Pacific? It could be, you know, 4,000 miles away." He said, yeah, but they were looking at something maybe in the Philippines or something. And then all the team members, Ian Griffith and Steve Price, recalled that the operations director on the research vessel Petrel, Paul Allen's ship, was a former colleague of theirs, Rob Kraft. And they said, "Well, we should try and contact them and see if they can help us out, because they have their own robot, they have their own deep sea drone that's rated to 6,500 meters, or 23, almost 24,000 feet. And it is a marvelous tool. It's top of the line. I mean, you know, if you're somebody like Paul Allen, you can afford, you know, the best that money can buy." And sure enough, we contacted them, and it's just maybe in this respect, the maritime industry still works a little bit like in the old days. If you know somebody and you've worked with somebody a long time ago and you had a good rapport, that's usually not forgotten, because you trust each other, and especially when you work in the deep sea in the diving business. And so Rob Kraft responded very quickly and said, "Yes, in principle that's possible, because we are on our way from the Philippines to Honolulu."
Just by luck, sheer luck, right?
We're like, "I think we just found a lottery ticket that may have a winning number." And so I then, of course, I was also involved with reporting the whole disaster to my superiors at UH, to management.
Yeah, break the bad news.
Yes, you got to do it. If something breaks, if something bad is going on, that's what you got to do.
It's, yeah, Boy Scouts honor.
You got to speak truth to power, and you got to come clean when something goes wrong. Anyway, they were also all over it. They said, "Give us the number, give us the contact of the Petrel, and we will try and work it out with the federal agencies to see how that can be arranged." Petrel announced that they had some mechanical issues to take care of, and if it were possible, they would like to ask if we had some space at our pier, Pier 35, UH Marine Center, just right around from Costco there. And it happened so that at that time there was mooring space available for them. I mean, now the Petrel is a fairly large ship, over about 300 feet long, so it's pretty massive, a wonderful vessel. They came in late July, which was about 10 days after we lost her. And we immediately went to work with them and developed with the Petrel team of salvagers. Although those guys are great pilots and manipulator operators, and most of them have salvage oil field backgrounds, and they're very good at what they do. If you check them out on the web, they have an unbelievable website, and you get
so much
information of what they find, and the quality of their data is just wonderful. So they invited us on, and for us it was just an eye-opener. I come from manned submersibles myself, so even after 5 years I would still consider myself a fairly newcomer to the world of robotics and tethered vehicles. And those guys, it was literally like Star Trek. I mean, you have an unbelievable control room with so many high-quality monitors, and you know the vehicle itself has two of the best manipulators that money can buy. The Schilling Titan IV, they're called. We have one that's our pride and joy on the Pisces 5 submersible. So we worked a strategy out. So we worked out a method to get it back with a so-called elevator that had about 290 pounds of lift. The elevator was deployed by us with our own research vessel, the Kilo Moana, during a Hawaii Ocean Time Series cruise that goes into that area. And so we deployed that elevator near the stricken ROV. The elevator, you just put a bunch of weights on that will drag it down to the ocean floor. And then 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, finally the petrol was ready. They had taken care of all their needs, their mechanical repairs. It was time on August 28th to go up there and get it. And we just got so lucky that on that day, August 29th, the ocean was flat calm. It was like a mirror up there. And we started the operation at 5 o'clock in the morning, took about a good 2 hours for the petrol ROV to reach the bottom, took 20 minutes to find our ROV, took another 20 minutes to find the elevator, transport the elevator over to the ROV, make a hookup with a lift cable, release the elevator, bring the petrol ROV up on deck. And then once they were on deck and out of the way, we acoustically released the weights from that elevator. The elevator was now attached to our ROV and had more buoyancy than the ROV had negative buoyancy, and it dragged it all the way up. It took about 2.5 hours for it to come up, and the whole up. And then once it was on the surface, since conditions were so great, the main difficulty that we had anticipated, which was that it might be rough on the surface and we might have a very hard time to rig the ROV and the elevator back to the crane on the ship, was just child's play. It was really easy. So we got it back, and I think by just before 2 o'clock, we had everything back on deck.
So did you celebrate?
Well, yes, we did. Yes, we did. There was great, great relief and great hooting and hollering. And the petrol is, of course, a private vessel. Unlike the federal vessels, they do not have a zero tolerance policy. And the crew of the petrol, they knew how happy we were. And
broke out the beer?
Within 15 minutes, they had a big cooler of beers on the back deck and fired up the Barbie, and we had a really good time, yes.
And so how was the condition of the ROV?
We were just amazed. We took an image when we reached it on the ocean floor once we were close by, and she looked just pristine, except there was no tether, no cable on it. She had just been sitting on the ocean floor waiting for us to come back and get her. The only thing that looked out of place was the port side, so the left side manipulator that had slumped over a little bit. All the oil reservoirs were at the same filled state as we had left it 40 days earlier. There were several components, like thruster motors, one or two thruster motors that had suffered some pretty heavy corrosion during the time. But we brought her back up, and we rinsed her off, and we put her in the shop, and we got together, and it took us about 2 weeks to make sure, you know, you go through a very elaborate power-up process. Everything was working. It was just astounding. I think there was maybe one or two small power supplies for lights that had, you know, when the cable parted and there was a power surge that, you know, was broken, and that could be replaced within a half a day.
So all the stars lined up for you?
All the stars lined up. I mean, in Germany we call it Glück im Unglück. You're lucky within a disaster. You know, that it's just, it was terrible to lose it, and it was very stressful for all involved. But the day of the recovery, you a rare confluence of luck and, of course, skill by the operators and also a good job by the planners.
So what does it say about the, I guess, the camaraderie with the mariners out there, the researchers?
Well, one thing that is age old in the mariner's world is we all love to help each other out when it's serious. You may have just heard the Kilo Moana just returned from a cruise to Tahiti. And while they were doing research down there with a group out of Columbia University, there was a stricken sailing vessel, a stricken catamaran. It had sprung a leak, had a hole in one of the hulls. And the Kilo Moana was the closest vessel at 200 miles away. And they received the SOS, and they were asked by, they were told by the equivalent of the Coast Guard in Tahiti that, you're the closest vessel. And they took them 2 days, and they steamed over there. And while they were steaming over there, they got together with the manufacturers of the catamaran, got the plans, and built essentially a fix that they could install as soon as they got there. So it took them, I think they lost about 48 hours, and the science group was also very gracious and professional, and they could work it into their schedule. So it was really a wonderful thing. It made the news in the maritime industry. And this was kind of similar with the Petrel and Rob craft.
Right, because I think there's probably the feeling that there's it's man against nature out there, right? I mean, on the high seas. And when man can help man...
yes, the ocean, is boss. The ocean rules, and when the ocean wants to give something back, then it may be easier than you think. But if the ocean doesn't want to, you will never get it back. It will break you.
So, what did we learn from this? You folks just, managed to reach out to the right people at the right time. Everything worked. Better than planned.
Well, what I learned from it was because it went so flawlessly, this recovery from planning to recovery to organization with the agencies, that it really, for me, became an example of how it can be done in a best case scenario. So I put together a little talk, and I've given it so far once or twice, once to them. To the Marine Technology Society, and to just, it's almost like a best practices type of scenario, which everybody that works in the deep ocean is interested in. It's very difficult, this planetary exploration deep underneath what we call the big blue blanket. And when you're at 6,000 or 5,000 meters, and you're at 9 or 10 or 11,000 pounds per square inch, of pressure from all sides, the demands on the material and the technology are tremendous. And so every time people work through a technological hurdle, usually there's an interest to share that. I always like to think that luck favors the prepared. So if you do a good preparation, and every once in a while conditions come together that your plan can work out perfectly. We just had a wonderful time that evening. We were all sitting around the back deck, and we're just swapping sea stories. They were telling of adventures that they had, finding the Indianapolis, or, of their hopes and dreams when they were going out to Midway later, and of their future plans. What happened, after the passing of Paul Allen, how is that all working out? And so it was just a very collegial and positive gathering. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, we thank the crew of the Petrel for getting our robotics unit
us
back.
Too. Definitely a shout out to Rob Kraft and his guys.
Yeah. Well, what a gift we have this holiday.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We've been talking with Max Kramer about a story of what was to some Mission Impossible. Some might like to think Kramer has good karma. He was part of a team of the University of Hawaii's Undersea Research Lab, which for decades operated manned submarines. The pioneering program was shuttered this past year after decades of groundbreaking study, exploring undersea volcanoes and the like. And if you were wondering about the future of Lu'ukai, that wayward robotics unit, well, Kramer says that unit's preparing to go out again in January. And if Microsoft's Paul Allen was watching that rescue from heaven, your crew did good. Mahalo. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we celebrate an Asian American woman whose work led to one of the first documentaries to win an Academy Award. Li Ling Ai graduated from Punahou School and the University of Hawaii. In 1937, Ling Ai and Ray Scott of the Honolulu Advertiser traveled to China to document the conflict there. She sponsored the trip and served as a co-producer on the film. At the time, the U.S. remained neutral to Japan's increasing imperialism, but the film showed the brutality of the invading Japanese forces in China. In 1941, Ray Scott received a Special Academy Award for the film, and Li Ling Ai was listed as a technical advisor. While it made waves when it was released, the film faded into obscurity. In 2016, a documentary on the film and Ling Ai, filmmaker Robin Lung, searched for a copy. During that production, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences received a print of the film, but was only able to partially restore the print. Do you know the name of this award-winning film? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Cooking for 20 people is hard. Appetites differ, and so do taste buds. But having 20 people bring their favorite dish, that's easy. Potlucks are about sharing food, experiences, and the uniqueness of each dish. And when you think about it, HPR does the same, sharing food for thought and unique perspectives. From arts and culture to politics and history and, of course, classical music, HPR keeps you fed. Keep the food for thought coming. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org today.
Support for The Conversation comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for Waimanalo Health Center's expanded facility. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, ferrarochoi.com.
Honolulu Civil Beat, our online news partners, go poking around in the Honolulu Liquor Commission. Political and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us this morning to tell us about the difficulty it's having attracting investigators. Morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Catherine?
Good, good. So tell us about this story that Christina has.
Yeah, this is from Christina Jedra, our city reporter. She's off for the holidays, so I'm glad to pitch in. You know, Catherine, I know you as a longtime journalist. How many stories have we done on the Liquor Commission?
Oh, my goodness.
There's too many to even remember. But I think it's accurate to say, Christina says it in her article, that they've, well, there's been a toxic environment, a culture of corruption that has plagued the Liquor Commission, gosh, for at least 15 years. And according to Peter Nakagawa, that's the chief investigator for the commission that Christina spoke to, that's really hampering their ability to hire people and keep them on the job to do their job. Right now, they need 20 full-time investigators. They only have 11. And this is to enforce 1,500 liquor licenses on Oahu. It's quite a lot to do. So the scandal that has been longstanding, to which Mr. Nakagawa says they've really made a lot of effort, a lot of headway to try and change that, still is hampering their ability to hire people.
Right, so I guess people's perception is that it's still kind of tainted.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to go back. Boy, remember Herb Naone? I'm pronouncing it wrong. I knew I was going to butcher that one. Herb Naone back in 2006. That was the former chief security at Aloha Stadium. He pleaded guilty along with James Roddenhurst. Remember him as well, mm-hmm. a former liquor commissioner. They were basically extorting bar owners. The idea is that if you paid them, they would just sort of look the other way if you were violating the law. And these things made headlines and have stayed around. The job itself is no easy job to take. You're working nights, for one thing. That's a turnoff to a lot of people. Starting pay is only $41,000. You only need to have 2 years' experience, but getting people with police experience, investigative experience, is challenging, given that there are other jobs, like being a police officer, that they could go for.
Oh, yes, and they pay much much higher salaries than $40,000.
Right, and so what Mr. Nakagawa is saying is they really want to get people with a strong moral compass. They're emphasizing the quality of the investigations over the quantity, not trying to do all these investigations at once. They have had, however, this continuous problem with recruitment. Sometimes people don't even show up to the interviews that have been planned, and that is the concern, trying to get people to stay on the job, to do the job ethically.
Well, I know unemployment is down, so I'm just wondering maybe, you know, how much of that factors in to just not getting enough people to apply and follow through.
Yeah, I think that's a factor. One of the things that Christina did is she checked with the HR department, and they are looking at maybe revisiting the job requirements. Maybe they could be lowered a little bit to attract more candidates. But the salary issue, that has to do with the union. It's HGEA, Hawaii Government Employees Association, and that is by contract, by collective bargaining agreement. Those things are not easy to change. HGEA did not return Christina's call inquiring whether there could be some leeway regarding the salary. But that's, as you say, particularly when unemployment is so low, not just here in the state, but actually nationwide, that is really hurting attraction of good candidates.
So talk about the cases and the complaints that come into that office.
There are a variety, and they have kept investigators busy. Nakagawa did really, and I'm going to stress this point again, says they really do feel like they've made some progress in turning things around. But when you've had that culture of accepting briberies and people making headlines by going into jail, that really has only contributed to this lingering suspicion. But, you know, there's been a number of these things that have really made some big headlines over the years. And I mentioned Herb Naone and James Roddenhurst as being perhaps two of the more prominent. I will mention this one. In some cases, bar owners, bar workers have the liquor commissioners have actually solicited cash, but also even sex from people working. I mean, gosh, saying, look, unless you sleep with me, I'm going to report you and I'm going to write you up. And sure enough, some people have been going along with that, part of this culture of corruption.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. You know, it's funny, with all our years of covering the Liquor Commission, I was kind of shocked because I was in a Chinese restaurant, and folks from the liquor inspection team actually came in. It was the first time I'd ever seen
there.
That. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much, Chad.
Anytime, Kevin.
That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read reporter Christina Jedra's story online, visit civilbeat.org. You might take traditional banking for granted unless you're part of a growing number of people who live outside that world. HPR's Kuve Hirishi joins us live this morning to talk about that. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So folks living off this banking grid, we looked into this population here in Hawaii. About 20% of the population falls into these categories. We've got unbanked. So those are folks without a bank account. And then underbanked. So folks who have a bank account but don't fully utilize the services of their financial institutions for various reasons. And these numbers come to us from a 2017 survey that's done every 2 years by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, sort of figuring out how to increase economic inclusion. This term gets pushed around, but trying to bring these people back into the fold of mainstream financial serving institutions. So Jeff Gilbreth, Director of Lending and Finance at Hawaiian Community Assets, sort of explains why households here in Hawaii tend to choose to seek these services outside their own bank.
What this is for families is sometimes a matter of convenience. Maybe they can't make it to the bank or the credit union because they're working one, two, three jobs each day, but also just a matter of potentially having some accounts that have gone overdrafted and cannot open a bank account. The major issue that we are seeing with this is, yes, it can impact folks in their day-to-day financial situation, but it also is a major barrier for folks who need to access credit and capital to pay for a car, to fix a car, to pursue college or start a business or buy a home, to basically take that next step towards economic self-sufficiency.
So these folks, what ends up happening if they don't have access to, for example, a loan from their bank because their credit score is so low or because they don't have any sort of asset to leverage a loan on, they end up going risk paying high fees for things like check cashing services or payday loans, prepaid debit cards. These all come with fees that, according to Gilbreth's research, on average cost families here in Hawaii about $1,200, the fees alone on these alternative financial services. So we've got folks who are already living paycheck to paycheck, and then you factor in this added constraint of having to seek these costly alternative financial services. And that's the cycle that begins. And we got to speak to Shadell Majerme, who was caught in that cycle. She is a Hilo resident and mother of four. She said she was sort of living on the edge for a really long time, her husband and her four children, until she went in for some financial counseling to try to get out of that cycle. Here's Majerme.
She told me that, have you ever looked into saving money? And I was like, I can't. Like, I'm on a tight budget. There's no way I can save money. We try every month and there's nothing at the end. She's like, did you ever look at what you spend your money on? Have you ever tracked it? And I was like, track my money? Why would I want to track my money? I don't buy expensive things. You know, I buy dollar Hot Wheels. Those aren't expensive. So we sat there and we did a monthly spending plan. And she was like, if you spend $1 a day on just a Hot Wheel in the month, that's $30. In a year, that's even more. And I'm like, wow, that's a lot of money for Hot Wheels. I could have bought him that big toy he actually wanted.
So these sound like a fairly sort of rudimentary financial education type of deals, but for a lot of families, just the pressure of already feeling so constrained in terms of available income is part of sort of the psychology behind getting out of that cycle. But luckily for Majerme, with an aggressive savings plan and hours of financial literacy education, she was able after a year, get out of that cycle of living paycheck to paycheck. She has a little emergency savings set aside, and just, I think, earlier this month was able to move out of a two-bedroom apartment and into a three-bedroom house for her and her family. So financial education, I think a lot of advocates would say, can help and may be a key component to getting folks out of out of this cycle. But when it comes to the unbanked and underbanked, that lack of access when you don't have any assets, when your income is constrained, that barrier is the thing that keeps you in that cycle. And we've seen in this survey also by the FDIC that households are at higher risk of being unbanked or underbanked if they fall into that category, that mouthful of an acronym, ALICE. So asset limited, income constrained, but employed. ALICE was a term coined by United Way of New Jersey when they initially did a survey following the 2008-2009 Great Recession. They wanted to see how families are dealing or being impacted by the Great Recession. And now I think 23 states have done the same ALICE study, here in Hawaii in 2018.
But basically the idea is you're ALICE and you're down the rabbit hole.
Exactly. And we spoke to Norm Baker, CEO of Aloha United Way, who explained that once you get into the cycle, it's hard to get up.
During the recession, 6% of the households in Hawaii fell in from financial self-sufficiency into ALICE. So you say, well, 6%, 7%, that is not that great a number of of people. But in point of fact, it's 31,000 households, 120,000, 125,000 people. So it is a significant impact on our local economy. Fast forward to 2019, and most of us would probably say that we've recovered from the Great Recession. Everything seems to be going good. The stock market's doing great. The unemployment rate's low. Everything seems to be marching along fairly well. This ALICE population that fell into ALICE during the recession has never recovered.
And one factor that's contributing to that, keeping them in that position, is that lack of access to mainstream banking services. So really interesting sort of cycle and how we can get out of it. For Gilbert, who we spoke to earlier, you know, financial education can only go so far. Figuring out how to come up with alternative, I guess, least cheaper or more affordable alternative financial services is something that he's working on to help folks get out of debt. Here's Gilbreth.
We need to expand this conversation about unbanked and underbanked to really talk about access to capital and credit for our families. And if we don't talk about this, again, you're going to see families where one hardship, one emergency happens, and they're going to be in complete financial ruin, you know, potentially leading to homelessness. But as a community, I think we need to recognize the importance of that next step, which is getting access to loans, access to credit, mortgage financing that is affordable for our families so they can move ahead and not be stuck in the cycle.
So for Hawaiian Community Assets, they offer low-interest microloans in place of for folks looking for payday loans. So payday loans have, what, 400% interest?
Oh, I know. It's so
and,
sad.
So figuring out other ways, I think Bank of Hawaii just came up with 2 years ago a second chance banking, so an opportunity for folks who have been blacklisted by mainstream banks to try a bank account so that they have access to paying online or a debit card that doesn't have any sort of financial transaction fees.
Right, but I guess the word of warning is you don't want to get it.
You don't
want to
get there in the
web
first place.
Yeah, and if you are, just get out. Try and do your best to get out.
That's right. And next year, the FDIC should be coming up with an updated survey and numbers. So far across America, about 32 million folks households fall into this category.
Wow.
So.
Interesting. Thanks so much, Kuvehi.
Mahalo.
We've been talking to HBR reporter Kuvehi Hiraishi. She's got a story about the growing number of people caught in the underbanking web. Find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Today's Backyard Quiz, we look at an Asian American who made filmmaking history. During her life, Lee Ling Ai served as a confidant to Ripley's Believe It or Not. She was a dancer, a relief worker, and a theater director. But she's also known for co-producing a documentary with Ray Scott. The two traveled to China to film the Second Sino-Japanese War. The final 20 minutes of the film shows the Japanese bombing the city of Chongqing. Released in 1941, it received worldwide praise and the attention of President Franklin Roosevelt. The movie was called Kukan, which means heroic courage in the face of suffering. Ray Scott received an honorary Academy Award for his extraordinary achievement in producing Kukan, the film record of China's struggles, including its photography with a 16-millimeter camera under the most difficult and dangerous conditions. And although she was a co-producer and sponsored the movie, Ling Ai was listed as technical advisor on the film. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has a partially restored version of the film. A full version has not been found. And congratulations to winner David Delaney, who called in from Mission Viejo, California. He usually listens in Honolulu, but he's traveling for the holidays. But thank you for listening. That's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation supporting the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting works from its school students in 2019 Fall Young Artist Exhibition through December 27th, honolulumuseum.org.
Moloka'i Bound is a new short film directed by a native Hawaiian filmmaker. It features a brief interaction between a young man and a child whose uncertain relationship moves from resentful to playful to tragic, all within the span of 8 minutes. The film was shot on location in Kaneohe, and its dialogue is almost entirely in pidgin. Here's a brief clip.
All right, how's it?
It's okay. Would be better without the lihing.
Bruh. What kind of Hawaiian is you?
Lihingwai isn't even Hawaiian.
I like stamps anyway.
Get your own.
Oh, you like your name? Well, if you name me something strong like Ikaika. On warrior's name, not Jonathan. Right, that's the name for a colonizer, cuz.
People call me Johnny.
People call me Noah.
In September, the film was screened at the Imagine Native Film Festival in Toronto, the world's largest presentation of Indigenous creative media. There, it won the award for Best Live Action Short. This year was the first that Imagine Native operated with Oscar accreditation, so is being considered for an Academy Award. Filmmaker Alika Maikau talked with The Conversation's Harrison Patino about the motivation behind the film and the long road to a possible Oscar nomination.
It's crazy. It's surreal because I'm still processing it probably. I don't think anybody sets out to make a short with Oscar ambitions in mind. I mean, I don't know if people set out to make features with that in mind, but definitely not shorts. So the festival for Imaginative, this is their first year with Oscar accreditation. So literally, like, they announced that right before they announced the award for the best short. So it was like this really crazy 1-2 punch that I think I'm still processing, to be honest.
So getting into the movie itself, the setting and the scene of it is pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward, but it has a lot more deeper implications. What was it like to write this? What was the writing process like?
It was kind of a different writing process for me. I was sort of challenged to do it basically by my cinematographer. It all started on a trip to New Zealand. I was attending a film festival called Māori Land in March. And I was participating in this thing that they had called the Native Slam, which is a 72-hour film challenge. And they fly you up there and they pair you with a host in New Zealand, and you have 72 hours to make a film. And then you go down to this festival called Maoriland, and at the end of the festival, they air all of the 72-hour films. So that, coupled with the fact that I was housed with my cinematographer, Chapin Hall, who I had never really met before prior to the trip, but I hadn't talked to him that much. So the fact that I was with him during this process and we went through this together, the 72 hours is like a grueling, stressful amount of time to make a film, but at the end of it, you have a film. And that was really special to me. And Chapin felt the same way. And so he had these beautiful lenses with him. And when we got back to Hawaii, he was going to be there for another week. So he said, if I could write something within a week, he'll shoot it. And that was sort of the impetus for me to write this. I had this loose idea for this film in my head. And so...
So from what I understand, you did him one better and you wrote it in a day. Is that true?
Well, not in a day, but throughout the week, I sculpted it. And also, I live with the lead actor. This is his second time acting. He acted in my last short. And so the fact that I'm spending, like, I'm in such close proximity to him meant that I could, like, bounce ideas off of him and, like, we could sculpt this thing together pretty intimately. And I feel like I have a pretty good idea of his voice and what he's capable of. So together we were able to craft this thing.
So I'm glad you're bringing that up. The boy and the man in this film are non-professional actors. Was that important to you to utilize non-professional actors?
Yeah, well, it's definitely important. The Wire is a super important text for me, like as a show and as a piece of art. The way that they've incorporated non-actors with professional actors was something I always found really compelling, and especially when they're trying to depict a place that's so specific and a language that's so specific to the region. So that was a model I've looked at. And so with my roommate, we both grew up in Kaneohe, and he knows how these characters speak and he knows how they act. And he grew up in this culture and these sort of the stories that we're trying to tell even closer than I did. So that's a huge part of it.
And this was filmed in Kaneohe?
Yes, this was filmed on the steps of Ohuimanu Elementary, which is where I went to school. And yeah, it was great to return back there and shoot something.
Was that important to you to imbue a really personal aspect to this film?
Yeah, I mean, this film and my prior film were both set in Kaneohe, and they've been sort of the most successful things I've done. And if I'm stepping back, it's probably because I'm sort of trying to write things that I've been closer to. And so, you know, I love where I'm from. I love being from Kaneohe, and I just want to show it. I want to three-dimensionalize the people that live there and also the space in a way that people can understand that it's, yes, it's beautiful, but there are other things that we deal with just like anywhere else.
So a lot of mainstream films that feature Hawaii as a setting have a really unfortunate habit of whitewashing the cast or putting a gloss on daily life here or putting the people of Hawaii secondary to the location. Why was it important to portray a more honest, blue-collar depiction of life here in Hawaii?
I'm just interested in stories that, like, I feel like there's a million stories with white people in it at this point, and there's just not as many with indigenous people. So to me, it's just important to see the people that I grew up with depicted on screen and people who look like myself. And the best way to do that is by casting yourself and making that film yourself, because oftentimes bigger productions can tend to want to come in and whitewash things.
The film features pigeon dialogue. Why was it important to feature that as opposed to something that maybe a wider audience could more easily understand?
To me, pigeon is interwoven into the fabric of Kaneohe identity and Hawaiian identity. And so if we're going to tell this story authentically, that language has to be as authentic as possible. And I just love pigeon in general. I think it's a beautiful dialect, and I hate when people get it wrong. So I really want to use people that I think know how to utilize it.
What did you hope people walked away with when they walked away from seeing this film?
I hope they walked away wanting more, I guess. And I shot this as a proof of concept for a feature film. And so I actually just finished writing the feature script, and we're trying to develop that right now, and we're aiming to shoot that next summer. So hopefully if if people liked it and wanted more, they can, you know, stick around and tune in for what we're doing next.
So we touched on this a little bit earlier, but this film presents a really earnest and somewhat complicated portrayal of daily life here. Is that something that you hope more films in the future can take a more active approach?
I think for the Hawaii film community to grow, I think there should be like an array of stories, and they don't all need to be sort of this blue collar, like tougher, rougher on the edges thing. It's just these are the stories right now that I feel are important to tell. So that's what I'm interested in. But, you know, Hawaii is a diverse place and we have many, many, many tones. So this is just one tone I'm interested in right now, but I would like to expand that eventually.
That was the conversation's Harrison Patino talking with Alika Maikau, the director of the award-winning short film, Molokai Bound. Have to go, but up tomorrow, we hear from Hawaii companies doing business in Hong Kong over the last 6 months of political unrest and the protests that don't seem to want to let up. We'd like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. And if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, find them all on the conversation page. Just look under HPR News and Talk for the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of the conversation.